given how unpopular such a change would be. But Macron appears to be betting that polls are correct and that he'll win re-election.
Plenty of people die before the age of 65. Can they never retire? Plenty of workers have physically demanding jobs and are poorly paid. Should they live in poverty and work until their death as well? 65 is way too late, and it's another step too far by Macron.
Austerity, then the coronavirus, now the Ukraine-related instability. Many say France is on the brink of a return to yellow vest levels of unrest if more far-right economic policies are demanded of the average person, but not of the rich.
Raising the retirement age is a certain way to reduce the number of available jobs. So from an economic point of view, not only would this not solve our unemployment problems, but it will actually be counterproductive. Macron is doing things from a purely ideological perspective and not at all with a view of helping the people of France.
France's presidential election has been dominated by disinterest. Voters have tuned out a campaign which was based on Islamophobia and xenophobia, and then the unrest in faraway Ukraine. Many wonder if Macron's call to raise the retirement age may have awoken a sleeping giant, the French public.
France seems to be ignoring or has forgotten about the presidential election, but regular protests are reminding the country of the long-running domestic issues which France still faces. Some of the answers may be fought out in the streets over the next month. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, in the previous episode, you heard the story of Imam Khomeini's residence in the holy city of Qom with Lady Khadija Saqafi, whose father was one of the renowned ulema in Tehran. Today, we will touch upon Imam Khomeini's simple way of living according to his wife. Stay tuned, please. Imam Khomeini's fourth house in Qom was much smaller than the previous ones. It was in the poor neighborhood of the city. After 3 years of residing in the third house, the Imam had to leave to somewhere else. Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Sadiq Lavasani, who used to help Imam Khomeini in such affairs, tried to find a new house for him. Due to the Imam's poverty, he had to rent a smaller house. Lady Khadija Saqafi says in this regard, Mr. Ruhollah Khomeini had found it better to do so. He was right. There was no income after all. I mean, it was not regular and continuous. He would not get the stipend either. And there was no other money. When he had seen this house, it seems that he didn't like it. He came and told me, You two go and see it. I said, no, it is okay for me if you like it. I wish I had gone and seen it. In that case, I would not step in that house. When he had told Mr. Sayyid Sadiq that the house was not suitable, he asked why. The rent of this house is 3 tomans per month, while the current house is 5 tomans. Is it bad to save 2 tomans every month? Khadija Saqafi was a patient and rational woman. Thus, she didn't disagree and never disputed with the Imam to pressure him. She lived in this humble house from the age of 19 to 27. Yet, she never complained, as she knew well that her husband was in economic pressure. She relates, on those years, Mr. Ruhollah knew my temperament well and knew how to behave to calm me. I always lived with him sincerely and purely. He would always compensate our poverty with kindness and expression of love. Of course, he never believed that we were in bad condition because the condition of the students at that time was worse than ours. The Imam believed that one is not poor as long as he doesn't eat carrion. He would tell me, thank God, we have always been well off. Imam Khomeini had such a lofty spirit that he didn't let the robbers of their house be exposed and insulted among people. He told his wife, they're good people and the robbery had originated in their need. We should pardon them. She pardoned them verbally, but the Imam told her that she had to forgive them in her heart. In a similar incident, a woman had stolen Lady Saqafi's handbag in Najaf. The lady knew her and wanted to pursue her and get back the handbag and its content. But Imam Khomeini dissuaded her as he was very careful to not to tarnish people's repute. He knew that the woman was poor and he didn't like to disgrace her among people. This spirit of forgiveness was in circumstances that Ruhollah and Khadija had economic problems themselves. Lady Khadija had become weak when she was expecting her third child. She says, At the time of Ahmad's birth, I was so weak that I couldn't even moan. And at the moment of childbirth, there was no one except my 9-year-old daughter. As soon as seeing my fainting, Setire had run and informed her father, saying that I had died. It was at the midnight that I regained my consciousness of the pain in my neck. I saw that Mr. Ruhollah was massaging my neck vessels. I opened my eyes, but fainted again. This happened several times, but I had no ability to talk because I had not eaten anything for several days. Imam Khomeini and his wife were so magnanimous that they never asked anyone for financial help, despite dire need. Lady Khadija relates a memoir on this. When she had gone to Tehran for her stomach ulcer, she had paid a visit to her sister, whose husband was a colonel. As she saw Khadija's son, Ahmad, in poor condition, she told her, "What kind of life is this? Winter, snow, and tattered shoes." Khadija was very upset and could not forget those bitter remarks for years. Imam Khomeini was in poor economic conditions, but he would not give up worship and studying. Lady Khadija says, "The whole thought and love of Mr. Ruhollah was studying and teaching. He used to wake up for midnight prayer. Then he would be engaged in studying and then teaching till night, that he would sleep again. He had said several times, 'I do not prefer anything to my ritual duties and studying.'" Dear listeners, Imam Khomeini was a very kind person with his family. He would never let the family affected by daily debates between him and his wife. He would always be the first to solve differences and make peace. Ms. Fatemeh Tabatabai, Imam Khomeini's daughter-in-law and wife of Haj Ahmad, says in this regard that when she and Haj Ahmad had gone to visit the Imam for the first time after marriage, he left them for midnight prayer. He told them, "You can speak with the lady, my wife. I have to take care of my affair." Ms. Tabatabai says, "I asked Ahmad in surprise when the Imam had gone. Ahmad answered that he had gone for midnight prayer. I had expected him to be more with his daughter-in-law and grandson, whom he was visiting for the first time, but he told us to rest as we could visit him again the following day."
Doing a song from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to another edition of Spotlight. Now, the Russian-Ukraine conflict has already had an immense impact on economic activities and inflation through higher energy and commodity prices. But recent developments suggest that it will also lead to a shift in international commerce as well by reinforcing the anti-dollar axis. Russia now wants what it calls unfriendly countries to pay for Russian gas in rubles, a demand that has sent European gas prices surging. Despite opposing to the move, it appears that the West has difficulty in circumventing an energy superpower. In this edition of Spotlight, we will be discussing the impact of the Russia-Ukraine conflict, particularly on global energy supply. Now, in this edition, we have two guests from New York and Brussels.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
And I would like to start with our guest from New York. Now, Russia is insisting on receiving gas payments in rubles. To what extent do you think the currency switch is justified in the wake of sanctions imposed on Moscow?
Oh, it's extremely justified. I mean, the U.S. has seized Russian assets, at odds with its previous promises to exercise financial fiduciary responsibility with regard to those assets. And Russia is quite alarmed and therefore is clearly in the process of transferring itself out of dollar-based assets into ruble-based assets that presumably would be beyond the reach of U.S. financial authorities. And what's more important is that other nations are getting the same message and responding accordingly. So so not only is political power breaking up around the globe, but financial power as well, as countries like China and Russia take steps to protect themselves against U.S. seizures of this sort.
Thank you. Now to our guests in Brussels. How much do you think this retaliatory move by Moscow would be effective, considering the explanations that we just heard?
I think it will be effective, because Europe has no choice. I think you have a lot of whistling in the dark here. People like Chancellor Scholz, who's giving a bright image to the possibilities of Germany and other European countries getting around Russian supplies, or the commissioner of the European Union, von der Leyen, who has instructed all member states of the European Union not to comply with the Russian demand. But that's total folly. The Russians have made it fairly clear that they will turn off the switch, which means that Europe will land in a disaster. The issue is not whether prices for gas will go up. They will go up. The question is, will there be any gas? And in the immediate days, weeks, and months, there will be no gas. And European industry will shut down. People in their homes will not have heating. And it's all completely unnecessary. It is pure stubbornness and the mistaken belief that Europe has greater leverage with Russia than Russia has with Europe. It will fail.
Back to New York. G7 countries have not accepted Russia's condition, and at least not just yet. Do you believe, like our guest from Brussels, that eventually they will have to?
Yes, I think that Russia has the upper hand. I mean, energy prices are rising, and that benefits energy exporters like Russia or the Persian Gulf states. So Russia has the advantage, and Europeans are at the disadvantage. So they'll have no choice. Their choices will be to face a drastic cutoff in energy supplies, which will lead their industry in ruins and will also lead to severe political, turmoil, or give in to Russian demands and begin paying for natural gas in rubles.
Okay, so all of this, I believe, is spelling a new economic world order. Let's go back to Brussels to Gilbert Doctorow, independent and international affairs analyst. So Putin is obviously not isolated despite the Western sanctions. At least in Asia, we know that he has a handful of partners that support its de-dollarization policies. Are you looking at a new economic world order here?
Well, I believed from the very beginning of this conflict that a new world order would emerge. I have to admit that I didn't anticipate it would take precisely the form it's taking. I expected there would be a bipolar world with Europe and the United States on one side and Russia and China on the other. What I see now forming is a constellation of the West, headed by the United States, with the European Union, with the UK, Canada, Australia, and a few other odd countries, facing against the Russia, China, India, and the global South. Now, the Indian element here is extremely important and could not be anticipated. Everyone was talking about China. It was China, China, China. The Chinese are backing Putin, and the support from President Xi made the whole invasion possible. However, in terms of real open and transparent assistance, Russia has benefited much more in recent days from India, because Russia and India concluded an agreement whereby the now fast expanding Russian sales of crude oil to India will be settled in rupees. And the rupees will be used by the Russians to invest in Indian state bonds. Now, if you look at it, that is essentially the type of formula that lay behind the petrodollar from the 1970s. So the uniqueness of the American dollar as the world's reserve currency is being challenged directly in the latest agreements between India and Russia, and we may expect them to be a model for future agreements between Russia and China.
Now, thank you very much. Mr. Lazar, as we just heard Mr. Doctorow pointing out to the fact that we were expecting a Russia-China partnership, but joining that partnership is now India. There is also Turkey and Iran in the line. So India has reportedly expressed interest in an alternative to SWIFT, and that would allow it to trade with countries under U.S. sanctions. All this is pointing to a very big shift. Do you believe that this is possible? How likely is it to happen?
Oh, it's very possible. And I think the more the U.S. pushes, the likelier it will be. SWIFT essentially is a giant email system, which allows members to engage in financial transactions, across the globe with a few clicks of the mouse. But the U.S. controls it, and the U.S. had previously run it in a relatively objective, neutral fashion. But the politicization of SWIFT, which has occurred since the Russian invasion of Ukraine, shows the U.S. is not going to do that anymore. So therefore, it makes it all the more urgent for other countries which don't want to, be at the mercy of U.S. Financial blackmail to establish an alternate system that they will control, that will accomplish the same ends, but will do so while removing the threat of U.S. political interference.
Well, thank you very much. Back to Mr. Doctorow. Now, let's discuss something that is very important at this point. How do you assess U.S. efforts to lessen European countries' dependence on Russian gas?
Well, that has been a stated U.S. objective since early in the Trump administration. There's nothing new in that. The question is, to what extent the United States can provide the gas, which is limited, it takes time to ramp up production and to add super tankers to carry the gas. And at the end of the day, everyone knows that pipeline gas, is much cheaper intrinsically than the compressed liquid gas. That is simply a question of transport costs. The liquefaction and the regasification, all of those are expensive and capital-intensive operations. So the United States plan was fine words, but it's not easy to follow through on them.
So, Mr. Lazar, adding to that, let's also point to the Persian Gulf littoral states and the comments that have been made recently by countries like Qatar, the UAE. While they're obviously not capable of replacing Russian gas, and they're not willing to either. We just heard from Qatar that said it will not be able to replace Russian gas, and also OPEC Plus did not back this policy. So what does this spell for Europe?
I think the U.S. is in big trouble. I mean, I think we're seeing the eclipse of U.S. global hegemony. Shortly after the invasion, there was a vote in the U.N. General Assembly, to condemn Russia for its actions. And really, three-fourths of the world's population vote either abstained or voted no on that resolution. So the U.S. is facing a huge rebellion, a huge mutiny. A global mutiny against its power, and the reason is very simple. I mean, the U.S. has been on a rampage for 25 years. Its behavior has been hypocritical in the extreme. Everybody knows that, and I might add, the people of Iran know that especially. And so everyone knows that, and people have reached the breaking point. They are just tired of it. They don't want to put up with it any longer. And now the system is coming apart at the seams. And so I think we're seeing the breakup of the old order and a crystallization of a new kind of financial structure.
Now, this question is one that I would like both of you to answer. What other options do Europeans have in terms of energy supplies? Mr. Doctorow?
Commit suicide. What they're doing now is extremely foolhardy, and I can't believe the incompetence of European leadership. But when you look at them one by one, you begin to understand. Who are these people? Ursula von der Leyen, the head of the European Commission, she is by education a gynecologist. Her knowledge of economics is obviously close to zero. And she has usurped the power of the sovereign state members of the European Union to instruct them not to buy Russian gas for rubles. This is madness. You look at the single biggest member state in terms of economy, Germany, and Chancellor Scholz. He was the mayor of Hamburg, and his mental breadth width is that of a German mayor. He had zero experience as a federal administrator, and he's speaking in a mindless way. His cabinet, which was put together by opportunism, to get to seize power, and by bringing in Greens and others who have no common agenda with his own party, was only opportunistic. And the result is total incompetence. Unfortunately, that is a widespread situation in Europe, and it explains the lemming behavior that we see now. I think of last week's crash of the Chinese 737. It went straight down. And that's what Europe is doing now. It is going vertically down and accelerating.
So, Mr. Lazar, you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I do. I'd phrase it a bit differently. Olaf Scholz, the German chancellor, was the candidate of the German Socialist Party, the Social Democrats. This is the same party which in 1914 essentially agreed to the support the war effort of Kaiser Wilhelm, plunging Europe into a world war which led to something on the order of 10 million deaths. Essentially, the Social Democrats in the person of Olaf Scholz are doing the same thing. They are going along with Joe Biden's war drive. They are not raising a peep of opposition. And this war drive, if allowed to continue, will plunge Europe into the same kind of catastrophe.
So you also, like Mr. Doctor, believe that Europeans have no other options?
They do have options. Their option is to put an end to this madness, to try to push for a negotiated settlement in the Ukraine, and one which respects Russia's entirely legitimate security concerns and also tackles the problem of rampant neo-Nazism in the Western Ukraine.
Okay, so Mr. Doctorow, you talked about how Europeans are nosediving, but the main question for all of us outside Europe is how will any fallout affect global energy prices? Should we prepare ourselves for oil prices above $200 per barrel?
Look, the former energy minister that served for 10 years in that capacity in Russia, Mr. Novak, who is today the deputy prime minister, said a couple of weeks ago that if Europeans continue to behave as they are now, the price of a barrel will be $300. And he knows a lot better the economics of the oil business, much better than Madame von der Leyen or Mr. Scholz or Mr. Macron. They all are amateurs.
Okay, and Mr. Lazar, your opinion, should we look at oil prices above $200 per barrel or $300? As our other guest suggested?
I'm very bad when it comes to financial predictions like that. But yes, I think the price will continue upward as these tensions mount. I mean, U.S. policy since 1980 has been to control the global energy markets by controlling the Persian Gulf. And that is now falling apart as not only Iran, but also the Gulf states, you know, look to allies in China and Russia, and the U.S. finds itself shut out. So the U.S. is facing a failure all around in the Gulf, in the energy markets in general, in the European Union. Joe Biden is really on the edge of the precipice.
And as you mentioned, we are looking at a multipolar economy rather than a bipolar or even one simply controlled by the United States. Mr. Doctor, would you like to comment on that, this multipolar scene that we're looking at?
Well, exactly the constellation is difficult to predict. But I'd like to add one further comment to my remarks on the incompetence of European leaders. No country has a monopoly on stupidity. And I think we have to take a look back to Washington and who is sitting in the Oval Office. We have a half-wit. We have a senile president. And his handlers know that. And when he makes these stupid, offensive, and potentially inflammatory remarks that he's made about the leader of the world's other nuclear superpower, watch out. We are in very dangerous territory.
Okay, and Mr. Lazar, are we looking at a multipolar economic system now? And who are these economic powers in the new order?
Oh, we are definitely looking at a multipolar economic system. And the powers will be China first and foremost, Russia in terms of energy, India, which is clearly a rising economic power. And that is proceeding hand in hand with the breakup of political power as well. I mean, look at if India sides with China, Then the so-called Quad, which was the anti-Chinese alliance the U.S. is assembling in the Western Pacific, that obviously will be in ruins. So U.S. policy is failing there as well. I mean, Joe Biden is really an incompetent who has overplayed his hand, and the U.S. is really teetering on the edge of a major disaster.
Thank you very much, Mr. Doctorow. To wrap up this discussion, would you like to also tell us who you think will be global economic powers in this new economic system?
Well, let me just clarify. Yes, Russia will be a major power in the energy field. That is dictated by resources, competences, and markets. However, it would be unrealistic at this stage to speak about Russia as a major economic power. It simply has too much to do to expand its industrial base, to fill in all of the holes in its products and technologies and services, which were till now filled in by Western suppliers. So the major powers economically will be, of course, the United States. That goes without question. It's India, China, and a number of other countries, including assuming that the difficulties Iran is experiencing are overcome, there will be more players, not in the first league, but in the second league. And they will have an influence on the working of the board of directors of the globe.
Well, thank you very much. That was Mr. Gilbert Doctorow, independent international affairs analyst from Brussels. And we also had with us Daniel Lazar, journalist and author out in New York. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen for sharing your thoughts on this edition of The Spotlight.
My pleasure.
And thanks for following us.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Leader's New Year speech.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, delivered a live speech on March 21st, the start of the Iranian calendar year. Ayatollah Khamenei used to deliver the speech at Imam Reza's shrine in Mashhad, but for the third consecutive year, he hadn't gone to Mashhad due to the coronavirus pandemic. The leader started his speech with congratulating Nowruz and beginning of the new solar calendar century. Then he greeted the Imam of the Age, Imam Mahdi. May God expedite his reappearance. He also greeted Imam Reza, peace upon him. Then he reminded important points, which we will touch upon after a short break. Ayatollah Khamenei highlighted two important points on Nowruz. The leader first said that blending this national feast with remembrance of God, supplication, and spirituality is somehow unique. Then he continued, "At the moment of the turn of the year, each and every person and different strata, from the elderly, the elites, scientists, activists of various scientific fields, including missile, nano, biology, etc., to the youth who spend the feast in remote villages in jihadi expeditions far from their families to serve the people, all started this moment of the turn of the year with the prayer, O Transformer of State and Condition. They spoke with God and appealed to God and washed up their hearts with God's remembrance." This one point. Ayatollah Khamenei then spoke of a second point, saying, "Spring is the symbol of hope. It is the messenger of hope. Spring tells man that autumn and fall of leaves will surely go, and freshness, rebuilding, and renovation will surely come. This is the feature of spring. It gives the people such a message, the message of freshness, the message of growth. Of course, this hope has been additional in this year because of being accompanied by Mid Sha'ban, which is the birthday of the great hope of history and great hope of mankind and hope of the source of all moves and progresses. So let everyone strengthen the spirit of hope in people in speeches, messages, and Nowruz writings. Let the enemies get angry at the Iranian nation's hopefulness." Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, clarified the theme of this year, which he had already named as the year of production, knowledge-based, and job-creating. Explaining knowledge-based economy, he said, "It means that knowledge and advanced technology should have ample and complete role in every arena of production. When I say every arena of production, I mean even the choice of that productive work, because one does not need to do all productive works. The choice of that productive work should also stem from a scientific and deep-sighted look. This is the meaning of knowledge-based economy, which is involved in all economic arenas. Once we pursue this policy and set knowledge as the basis and background of the country's economy and increase knowledge-based economic agencies, which I am going to explain, it will have many benefits for the country and the country's economy. It will decrease cost. It means that knowledge-based economy will cause reduction of production cost. It will increase productivity, which is one of our problems today. It will increase and improve the quality of the product and will make products competitive.
The leader gave an example in agriculture, saying that an increase of knowledge-based companies can cause great developments. It will provide food security and the country will never face food problems. It will increase farmers' income and solve the chronic problem of water shortage. He added, in all other sections, too, whether the parts related to production or the sections related to services, these blessings exist. I mean the volume of production will increase, quality will be enhanced, and the cost price will decrease. In fact, making production knowledge-based will enhance economic activities. This is an important issue. It is a sensitive and fundamental point. Ayatollah Khamenei referred to 6,700 knowledge-based companies in Iran, saying, I expect the officials to double the number of knowledge-based companies in the new year to meet the needs of the country. In this way, creation of 300,000 direct jobs will turn into 600,000 direct jobs in 1401, the current year. The leader stressed that the increase of the number of knowledge-based companies is quite feasible with regards to the potentials of the country. He said, people and youth form these companies, yet government establishments should support them. Support mainly means to buy and use their products or provide them with facilities if they need any. According to reports, a high percentage of educated persons are employed in irrelevant fields, whereas we can use the endeavor of specialized and young forces who are the greatest wealth of the country to make the country wealthy. Ayatollah Khamenei continued, job creation will be achieved via these very knowledge-based companies. It means that if we are able to produce and create these companies in the true sense of the word, so that we will not make the mistakes that would sometimes be made in the past, jobs will increase. The leader of the Islamic Revolution stressed his previous warning on not tying the economy to sanctions and said, fortunately, the current policies in the country showed that this is a correct word and they did the same thing. Although there are American sanctions, one can enhance and increase foreign economy, which was increased. One can both enter regional contracts, which, thank God, the government ably entered and achieved progresses and enhancements in the field of oil and other fields. One can reach better situation, which, thank God, has occurred, although the American sanctions exist. Of course, I never say that we should not try to remove sanctions. No. I have said several times that there is no harm in the efforts that some people are making in this field. Let them pursue it. But the basis of the issue is for us to move and administer the country in a way that sanctions won't be able to deal a basic and serious blow to it. Ayatollah Khamenei referred to the increase of oil and dollar prices and said, these revenues can be dealt with in two ways. They can either be spent on increase of imports, thinking that this will increase people's welfare and comfort. Although this looks good, it has a very bad inward, and in fact, it means to destroy the fundamental assets of the country. Another way, which is the correct and basic way, is to use oil revenues for construction of the country's infrastructures and bolstering the foundations and deepening the roots of economy, which must be done. Ayatollah Khamenei then said, When you look at what is taking place in the world, you will see the rightfulness and honesty of the Iranian nation in confronting the front of arrogance more clearly than ever. Our nation's choice against arrogance was not submission. It was steadfastness, non-dependence, keeping independence, internal strengthening of the system, nation, and country. These are national decisions. This was correct. The leader briefly referred to the current developments and said, "This is Afghanistan. That is Ukraine, whose president addresses the West, while the Westerners and Western governments themselves have brought him to power with a harsh tone. These are the events of Yemen, an everyday bombardment of the oppressed and really resistant people of Yemen. These are the works of Arabia, which beheads 80 people in a single day. 80 youths and even teenagers whose news was spread. When one looks at these events, he feels, what oppression is ruling in the world? What a darkness is ruling in the world? The world is in the hand of what bloodthirsty wolves?" Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei concluded his speech with a sad reference to the Western racist approach and double standard policies. He said, "They explicitly express sorrow that this time war is not in the Middle East and is in Europe. It means that if there is war, bloodshed, and fratricide in the Middle East, in the regions of what they call as Middle East, and in these places, there is no problem. But if it is in Europe, there is such an explicit racism. This is another instance of duplicity in the Western world in the face of oppression and injustice, to the extent that if it occurs in their subject countries, they will show no reaction whatever, and they masquerade human rights with this much of oppression and injustice, and blackmail independent countries with this false claim." In the end of his speech, the leader called for solidarity, coherence, synergy, and unity among officials and various strata of the nation in a bid to achieve the goals of the Islamic Revolution.